You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Please join me in welcoming Tracy Deutsch.
Thanks, Terry, for inviting me to speak to you today and for that introduction. And thanks to all of you for coming. This book was fascinating to research and to write about, and I'm delighted to talk with you and also to answer any questions you have about this book or the topic of grocery stores and food distribution. I wanted to start by talking a little bit about how I came to this project, and in particular, how I came to this book. And then I'll launch into and sort of lay out some of the bigger themes of the project, and then I'll read some sections of the book where I sort of illustrate the different facets of grocery shopping. So I came to this project actually with what I was sure was a simple question, and that I would be able to finish my graduate research and my dissertation very quickly and move on. The question that I started with was, how did stores get so big? Why are grocery stores so large? And I was right about that part. By any measure, the size of grocery stores grew enormously over the course of the 20th century, from small neighborhood stores to the enormous superstores that we're so used to now. I was wrong about how easy of a question that was to answer. Understanding why that change happened took me into the realm of political economy, gender relations, ideologies of domesticity, and the emergence of a consumption-oriented political economy in the post-World War II period. It took me into the archives, into conversations, and into trade journals. And it made me realize the profound interconnectedness of capitalism and social systems, and the embeddedness of capitalism and systems of exchange in broader systems of hierarchy, power, and politics. That's what you get for imagining that you have a straightforward research question. I want to start partly as a way of explaining how I came to view this as a complicated question by talking about a description of a grocery store. This description was articulated in the fall of 1932, a moment when supermarkets were first emerging, and when the National Tea Company, a Chicago-area chain of grocers, had completed a massive remodeling of hundreds of their stores. These new stores had features that we associate with modern grocery stores. They featured up-to-date lighting, new aesthetically appealing refrigerators, a broad range of foods. In these stores, women could choose for themselves what they wanted off of open shelving. One director described these stores as, quote, a housewife's paradise. The director's description is compelling in a lot of ways. These were very aesthetically appealing stores, and they had a lot of products that we might imagine people wanted. The problem was that I knew that that person could not possibly have known what a housewife's paradise would have been or what women would have wanted. The size and layout of these stores and the focus on self-service made it nearly impossible for any manager or clerk to know what a woman might actually want. What the director said and what I was seeing was the creation of a construction, a rhetoric of women's demand. It's a rhetoric that continues to inform how we see consumption and food shopping, one that informed a range of policies around around wartime price controls, women's claims to political authority in the inter and post-war periods, a rhetoric that informed the fate of consumer cooperatives and efforts to rethink mass consumption, and of course, one that we see displayed in Cold War celebrations of capitalism. It's also a rhetoric that continues to inform how we think of consumption and food shopping. In a recent article, the head of Cub Foods explained dramatic changes to store layout by ascribing it to what busy moms want. And I think we see that rhetoric over and over again, both in celebrations of large grocery stores and in critiques and attempts to form alternatives, that the answer is always, what do women want? I learned as I did this project that this rhetoric of women's demand and of women as wanting this kind of store, one that's easy to navigate, one that is streamlined and aesthetically pleasing, is both performed in stores and constructed by stores, but also resisted in stores. It's a rhetoric that disciplines people as much as it frees them. And it's a rhetoric that assumed enormous importance for the operations of the state and of capitalism in the latter half of the 20th century. So in the end, my analysis undermined demand as a causal factor in the question of why supermarkets emerged. And instead, it forwarded, oddly, the significance of food and food shopping to political economy in the consumption-oriented U.S. state, and the significance of food to the reinforcement of racial and class hierarchies. It describes an emerging consensus about what kinds of political authority would accompany reproductive labor, what kinds of political authority women could claim as housewives. The book also described spaces in which these same hierarchies of race and class and gender and the state are fought. They're fought both in organized movements and also in everyday ways. And I try to tell that complicated story in this book. I want to describe a couple of big themes that emerged as I did the book. The first thing that I learned was that large supermarkets represented an enormous shift, not only in what stores looked like, but also in how people understood reproductive labor. The large standardized supermarkets that dominated the post-World War II retail landscape represented an enormous change in the ways in which women sought to feed their families. For much of the 19th and early 20th centuries, women shoppers had been expected to seek out bargains, to haggle with, threaten, praise, cajole, or shame the grocer as circumstances warranted. Indeed, women's primacy in food shopping was premised on their claim to authority in negotiations with retailers. But the premise that women needed authority over retailers had begun to fade in the decades before World War II. And after the war, women were expected simply to choose from grocers' offerings and to value low prices and peaceful anonymity above full service and personal attention. By the late 1960s, when this study ends, the woman supermarket shopper had become an emblem of the troubling political disengagement and dissatisfaction fostered by modern life. Other things, too, had changed. In the early 20th century, policies around food and food selling were locally set and premised on regulation and longstanding expectations of what counted as fair treatment. By the late 20th century, stores themselves were responsible for administering a range of policy, some of which was unrelated to food safety. Stores administered the sales tax, food stamps, and during moments of economic duress, price changes and price controls. In other words, the state had come to depend on stores. I quickly imagined that rather than think of stores as primarily economic institutions, it was more useful to understand grocery stores as spaces that encompassed politics of many kinds, and indeed to look to politics and power to frame understandings of grocery stores and shopping and systems of exchange more generally. In grocery stores, the former rules of governments intersect with the less formal power relations of social life. Sometimes ethereal ideas about how women ought to behave took on material, economic, and structural importance. Finally, grocery stores were sites not only for the purchase of food, but for the operations of the mid-20th century state and its increased dependence on top-down, standardized, and predictable consumption. Despite the frequent claim that supermarket shopping was a depoliticizing experience premised on individualistic satisfaction-seeking, supermarkets and other grocery stores were deeply political. The final sort of realization I had about grocery stores and supermarkets as I wrote this was that the notion that these are economic and social institutions ought not to be in tension with each other. In fact, grocery stores illuminate the connections between economic and social systems, and I think retail spaces often do this generally. They do this both in terms of the policy that stores administer, but also in terms of the everyday politics that happen in stores and that take on economic and political significance in those spaces. For instance, although the middle decades of the 20th century are often seen as a low point in women's activism in the United States, a close look at women's food shopping demonstrates that consumption remained a sphere in which women claimed authority in the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s, and that women's challenges to store operation continued in the post-war period. Similarly, a close look at supermarket operations suggests the contingencies of their growth and the work of social relations that was crucial to everyday operations. Taken as a whole, work on the social and institutional nature of grocery stores suggests a need to explain rather than assume the workings of consumer society. the seemingly stable liberal consensus of the Cold War period tells only part of the story. Matt's consumption was far less stable than policymakers had hoped it would be, and its everyday operations were far less secure. The story that I tell in this book reveals the work of maintaining it. So I want to now read a couple of sections where I talk about that work in two different ways. These are both from the early part of the book, so I'm talking about an era before supermarkets emerged full force, but in which some of the political pressures that led to the creation of supermarkets are starting to be seen. The first selection that I'll read is from the very first chapter of the book, and it talks about the ways that shopping was work. It sort of helps us to reframe food shopping as labor and talks about the kind of labor that it was and why it was so much work and how that mattered in terms of people's everyday lives, particularly women's everyday lives, but also families' everyday lives. The next selection talks about how that mattered structurally and in the context of the emergence of the sales tax, which happened nationally in the 1930s. That was when sales taxes emerged. And I talk about the difficulty that stores had collecting the sales tax from customers who were used to exerting themselves and exerting a certain amount of authority over grocers, so that these questions of social politics assume structural importance beginning in the 1930s. Okay, so this first section comes from a part of the book where I'm talking about the inflationary boom that happened all over the United States in the years around World War I. There was a huge, particularly spike in food prices. A series of letters in the Chicago Tribune between 1912 and 1913 described how families coped with the high cost of living and focused on corners cut in food purchases. One writer explained that she had, quote, solved the problem of living within their income through, quote, marketing. All of her examples were drawn from careful planning of food purchases, often substituting her own labor for buying processed goods. For instance, she bought cheap cuts of meat and ground them up, or did her own baking. Another woman wrote more succinctly, "I think the main trouble in fighting the high cost of living is in marketing." Another woman proudly recounted the ways in which she had structured her world around saving money on food. "We live near good markets and grocery stores," she explained. That, however, was not enough. In addition, quote, "I buy fruit in season, buying sugar at the lowest price to be ready for canning time, buy potatoes for winter from peddler and store in basement, buy flour at sale prices by 25-pound sack, do all own baking." The ability to economize on food was important both to these women's daily labors and to their understandings of their contributions to household life. Food shopping was one of a number of women's tasks that involved complicated financial strategies. One woman's recounting of how she made ends meet eloquently illustrates the inextricable entwining of commerce, domesticity, and pride. A letter writer to the Chicago Tribune, who shared a home with her brother and his son, took pride in their healthful living, which included plenty of nice milk and cookies for my boys, and in her family's savings account, which was meant to pay the boys' college tuition. But these accomplishments had a cost. She explained that they made do by eating meat twice a week and by her baking all of the family's bread. Moreover, she relied on a complicated combination of in-kind and cash exchanges to make ends meet. "One neighbor is glad to do my washing and cleaning for a little help with her sewing and fitting, which takes but little of my time. During the school year, I give Saturday afternoons and evenings to helping high school pupils in algebra, and often during the week, from 7 to 9 eighth grade pupils come in for help. For this work, I get 20 cents per hour. I work fine buttonholes for 25 cents per dozen and do fine darning on torn garments and lace. I am often needed as extra help in the stores." The accomplishments of this unnamed author attest to the melding of market and home, to the amount of work required even to keep up middle-class households, and to the meaning of shopping as skilled labor. A successful dinner, a savvy purchase, an opportunity to exercise authority over tradespeople, or to perform culinary and economic skills for other women, all of these could result from satisfying shopping. But it was precisely the transient and fleeting nature of these rewards that made food shopping so important and so difficult. Food purchases, perhaps the purchases over which women exercised the most control, were also the one commodity in which prices paid and choices made were most open to question. Every transaction represented labor saved, for instance, by purchasing processed food, or precious cash wasted by purchasing processed food of poor quality or that family members would not eat. Every transaction meant a choice, buying in bulk and preserving produce, or buying in smaller quantities to be sure that food did not go bad. Indeed, for all of economists' frequent admonitions that demand for food is inelastic, food choices felt, and I would suggest continue to feel, elastic, variable, adaptable, uncertain, and extremely weighty. Women's food shopping was, for all of these reasons, understood as difficult and important labor. And so now I'm going to switch to a different part of the book where I talk about attempts by grocers to begin to collect the sales tax, which was, it was unclear when the sales tax was first passed how that money would be collected. Many firms began collecting the sales tax only with great difficulty. One gas station owner pointed out that he could hardly force customers to pony up the extra 2% once the gas was already pumped and in their tanks. Even sellers who might have had more leverage over consumers frequently absorbed the cost themselves, approaching their customers with great trepidation. One milkman regularly budgeted an extra $1.50 into his cost to cover customers who refused to pay the tax. Similarly, grocers publicized their promise to collect the tax by folding it into the price, but then assured customers that they would only increase the prices of items not already subject to frequent market fluctuations. By adding the cost into prices and assuring customers that competitive goods would not be subject to the tax, grocers hoped to ease customers' resistance to paying the tax. One shopper's protests suggest the wisdom of grocers who tried to obscure the tax collection efforts. This letter to the editor of the Chicago Tribune was written 2 years after the tax went into effect. And the writer was still wondering whether the customer actually had to pay the sales tax. For instance, the unnamed author wrote, when shopping in a chain store where they take the money before they wrap up your groceries, if you refuse to pay the sales tax, can they refuse to give you your groceries? The question suggests the sort of shop floor confrontations that grocers feared, having to publicly force a customer to pay the tax, and thereby risking the loss of the sale, as well as alienating other customers. The letter also makes clear that a chain store actually did force the writers to pay the tax. This suggestion is in line with what seems to have been a greater willingness and ability among larger stores to collect the tax from customers. In these stores, shifting, adding the tax onto the customer's bill was common. In small stores, shifting or forcing customers to pay the tax was difficult. In one 1934 study, only 19% of small stores were able to shift all of the tax onto customers, but 92% of stores with sales above $100,000, or very large stores, were able to shift all or part of the tax. The same study found that customer resentment was the reason most commonly given by retailers who did not shift the tax. These statistics confirm what many merchants had earlier suggested. It was difficult for small retailers, dependent on their customer base and already competing with lower-priced chains, to pass on the cost of the sales tax. Over time, opposition to the sales tax increased. When the tax was renewed in 1935, independent grocers, liberal commentators, and groups representing unemployed workers voiced their opposition to this regressive tax. By the end of the decade, candidates for the state legislature and governor were seeking to capitalize on frustration with the tax by promising to reduce or eliminate it. But despite these outcries, the sales tax remained. Those anti-tax efforts that did continue seem to have been individual moments of resistance. Customers, it seemed, would just as soon fight out that issue with individual retailers rather than engage in large collective struggles. Consumers tolerated the idea of the tax, even if they did their best to negotiate its terms. In a few years, the sales tax had become a central feature of state finance. And so in the midst of the Great Depression, when Americans perhaps had the least disposable income, consumer spending became structurally tied to state fiscal stability. And with that, I will stop reading and take any questions.
I guess I have a big sort of question about if your work is so important in this emerging history of capitalism, and did that, as you were conceiving of this project, at the historical moment that I know that you can see.
Right.
like, did you know that that's what you wanted this story to be about, or did that emerge as you were writing?
Yeah, I knew I wanted it to be about capitalism, but I didn't know what that would mean. A lot of the literature that's really important to the field wasn't out then. And so it was hard in some ways to make legible all the different things that a history of capitalism ought to do. And I think, I mean, obviously I wasn't alone in trying to do that work, but that effort made me, just sort of sitting with the archives, I think brought home the many variables at play in any moment of exchange or economic transaction. And also, I will say that although it wasn't published, that was in the air at conferences and in seminars and things like that. So that mattered a lot. Yeah.
Just as kind of a related question, I mean, you could say the same thing about sort of food history and,
yes,
and all of this. And you, of course, addressed partly that question of the sort of the new politics of food in this radical history review piece you did.
But yeah.
Was that sort of part of your thinking, or were you pretty much finished before that really hit the...
I admitted that I was interested in food much later than I admitted that I was interested in capitalism. So that took a while. but I think that was a moment, that was a transition that I think reflected my own historical position, right? Living in this moment where food and admonitions, not just to eat certain ways, but to buy in certain ways, was everywhere. And so as I was sort of on my last round of revisions with the book, I realized I couldn't duck this anymore. And I sort of had to come to terms with the fact that this was not just a book about capitalism, but also a book about food. And that was, I mean, in terms of sort of future projects, I think that was crucial because it made me understand that, it made me reinforce and make explicit the point that capitalism happens over these everyday commodities, and that it's in those moments of everydayness that these larger systems are at risk or reinforced. So it was really useful, even though it took me an incredibly long time to admit that that's what I was doing. Yeah.
I'm just curious about sort of, you know, you did this academic dissertation on this topic, and then you have a book that I think has, obviously, what we're just talking about, has a lot of public appeal. So maybe you could talk for a minute about kind of your revision process and what you saw as, like, now you have this opportunity, right, to, like, do this thing that makes your work a little bit more public. And what were some sort of ways or areas that you focused on and that you really try to delineate a difference between an academic dissertation and a book that a lot of people would read on an issue that's really pressing?
Right. You know, one thing I learned in the process of revising the book is that, and we sort of all know this as scholars, but not always as people, that the public doesn't exist. And there are many competing ideas about what the public would like and what a public book would look like. And I don't know that I successfully negotiated that minefield about what it means to write something accessible, right? Because suddenly, you know, in that moment, the one thing I did realize was that suddenly I was the people I was writing about. Like, I had a product and I wanted people to buy that product. And I had to think about what would happen in the moment where they decided whether or not to buy the product. So ultimately, the way that I dealt with it was by trying to write as direct an argument as I could that was not also simplified, that wasn't overly simplistic, and being true to the impulses that had driven me to write the book, which was to describe a world that resonated and made sense to people. And I kind of felt like this is not a book that is a coffee table book. You know, it's not a celebratory history of supermarkets. And that if people wanted that, I was okay with them going somewhere else, that I was going to write the book that was true, that was complicated, because I think this is a complicated space. And ultimately, that's what I want people to know and to think about these spaces, to acknowledge the complications of these spaces. Yeah.
Okay. As you go through your discussion, I'm thinking about ownership of supermarkets.
Mm-hmm.
Who owns them?
Right.
The women are the women part of that ownership? Because they are the consumers and they are the drivers of supermarkets.
Right. That is a really good question. And it was very tricky for supermarket operators to negotiate that question. Because in fact, one of the transitions that accompanied the emergence of large supermarkets was women's loss of control and loss of ownership, their loss of control over enterprises, as well as a loss of authority and control over the space of the store. So the quick answer is no, they don't. But grocery stores acknowledge that this was a tension, right? And so there's a surge, and there still is a surge in rhetoric about how they do things because that's what women want, right? That women are really the people in control and they're just their puppets. And you see this rhetoric sort of blooming in the 40s and 50s. Yeah.
When you mentioned your book is really about the history of capitalism, which I was wondering, what was the macro idea?
Right.
I was just like, okay. I think my question is not almost similar to the previous one, but would you say in the, which is kind of a maybe a macro question, would you say women's role in the history of capitalism is commodified? I mean, is that, when it comes to food?
Right.
Okay, I'll say when it comes to food.
Yeah, here's what I would say, that gender is crucial to capitalism. I mean, individual women negotiate systems of, you know, buy and sell and paid work and unpaid work in an enormous number of ways. What matters increasingly to the everyday functionings of the stores was a sense that women operated as a collective, were a coherent group, and could be forced to behave in certain ways that fit with a gendered ideology of domesticity. And in particular, in terms of what I talk about, it mattered a lot to stores that they could make believable the idea that women didn't really want power and they didn't really want to negotiate and they didn't really want to assert themselves, that what they really wanted was to have shopping be easy and sort of relaxing and pleasurable. And that women would naturally sort of gravitate towards that kind of store. The store where it was easy and pleasurable and glamorous. So although individual women had very different experiences in stores and understood their food shopping differently and came with different priorities and didn't always do the food shopping, that understanding of exchange and consumption informed and like the emergence of the post-war consumer society and the ways that people understood that consumption as a whole ought to work. Yeah.
Well, I like the excerpt that you wrote, cause, you know, kind of working to reframe like consumption and economizing as actual labor. But I'm wondering if you wrote about the way that grocery stores were also a place to make like new kinds of lifetime paid labor. Right, and specifically thinking about how by the middle of the 20th century or by the 60s, I think, maybe you could talk a little bit about this, grocery stores became a place for unionized living wage labor, lifetime employment.
Right.
So right. What's the kind of hinge there between like consumption is labor and then getting a lifetime job, right? Because
right.
I would assume that many of the shoppers actually eventually became United Food and Commercial Workers members and worked at grocery stores for their entire life.
Well,
in some cases, in some places.
Right, some of them did. I mean, what happened is that grocery stores became sites of unionization campaigns.
Right.
And food shopping had a long history of being a site of unionization campaigns. And the UFCW was very successful in some places and very unsuccessful in other places. So and very successful with some firms and unsuccessful with others. So that some kinds of stores, in the one that I talk about in here is Jewel Tea Company, which both became unionized, but also had this very paternalistic, they were very sort of welfare capitalist kind of company. And so they had a lot of benefits for members and understood that working in a store could be a lifetime career path, but in an extremely gendered way. And this is something I don't talk about very much in here, but these very large corporations understood themselves, when they understood themselves as places where people would work for throughout their careers, understood those people as male. So the people who were promoted to, you know, their sort of expectations of who would work up through the ranks was men. There were some prescribed career paths that women followed, particularly in firms that had internal marketing departments and product testing and home economics departments. Women could sometimes rise through the ranks, although typically they went to university home economics departments and hired people. The people who really built longstanding careers and were sort of lifetime members of these unions tended to be men. In some places, part-time cashiers were active members, and in those places, women were more vocal union members and sort of saw it as a lifetime career. But the firms themselves rarely imagined that that the stability promised by these large companies was a stability that extended to wage-earning women.
And the unions didn't have a lot of leading women either.
They didn't have a lot. They had some. They had some, and they understood that part-time workers and women were important parts of their membership, but they didn't have a lot of headway, and it was hard to gain control. The other thing about supermarkets that is complicated is that there are, although the UFCW is the most important union in grocery stores, at various points in this story, a lot of other unions are also presences. Like, the butchers are organized differently. The bakers are organized differently. The fish counter can be organized differently. And in all of those unions, certainly for butchers and anyone who dealt with produce for some reason, those unions were actually much more resistant to women assuming positions of authority. And there were very little jobs available in those areas to women.
It's really quite paradoxical about women in supermarkets.
Yeah, and that's the paradox of this book, right? That this sort of flowering and celebration of women's authority accompanies this structural loss of authority. And not just in stores, I want to say, but also outside of stores, right? As women, because in the past, women had sort of asserted themselves individually against grocers. Beginning in the 1930s, many organizations, some were mixed sex and some were just women, began to lobby for consumer rights with the government and to assert themselves politically within sort of very traditional political spheres. The notion that women's real authority came through the actions of corporations and not through their own authority over the state or their individual authority over stores really sort of cut off at the knees the possibility of organized consumer activism. One section that I thought about reading that I didn't talks about the response to a boycott that happened in the late 1960s when women, there was a national boycott against high meat prices. And both people who supported the boycott and people who opposed the boycott described the women in the most astonishing terms. You know, they called it a lady cot. They said that it was unlikely that the experience of protest was searing for most women and therefore it would be unlikely to succeed. The government fired the woman who was, she wasn't in the cabinet, but she was the advisor on consumer affairs to the White House. And they fired her because she came out in support of the boycott and argued women should have authority over these stores. And instead, what grocers did was to they spent a lot of money publicizing these panels that they would have in cities across the country where they said they listened to women and then would do what they wanted in stores. But there was not only was there no structural change, there was no structural change for very gendered reasons, for reasons that separated anyone who assumed the mantle of women from the state, from government. So yeah, it was, it is an enormous transition, and it's one that is largely obscured in the way we tell the story about grocery stores, which is as a story about demand, right? Supermarkets succeeded because they sold at lower prices and people wanted lower prices, or they were convenient, or they were in near suburbs, or you could get to them with a car. And one thing I wanted to do with this book was to undo the notion that demand is what drives changes in business, and in particular in retail, because that's such an intransigent idea that it's demand that moves things. And it's just not true. or at least it wasn't true here. If we have a couple minutes, I'm going to share with you some things that I didn't get to talk about, but that struck me about the book and that I think are helpful in thinking about food politics now. Two things really surprised me as I wrote the book. The first was the complete erasure of what had been enormously rich and diverse food distribution systems. The neighborhoods, a lot of the neighborhoods that I write about in this book at the turn of the century, were places teeming with food. Peddler's carts, corner saloons, small neighborhood stores, public markets, farmers markets. All of these were part of an infrastructure that sent this constant stream of food through poor and immigrant and working class neighborhoods. It's not that everyone in those neighborhoods could afford the food, and it's not, you know, there was malnutrition, and the price of poverty was, as it is now, difficulty accessing the food, but the problem wasn't spatial. There was no such thing as a food desert. And now we associate poverty with a lack of access to food, with a spatial problem. And that's a much more difficult problem to fix, right? That means rethinking the infrastructure of whole cities. That happened because of this transition to large, centrally controlled supermarkets and the reliance of these large stores on very specific kinds of behavior, people who were able to buy in large quantities in regular cycles and take their food home with them. That's a way of buying that's very difficult for poor people, and for a variety of reasons, those stores left cities. But it wasn't because poor neighborhoods have always been without food. They were often sites of intense food distribution because people bought food every day in small quantities, which is harder to do now. The other thing that surprised me was something that didn't change, and that's the advice women were given about how to save money on food. I was struck as I went through some of the prescriptive literature from the first decades of the 20th century about how similar that advice was to advice that I saw when I turned on CNN, literally. Women were told to buy in bulk, to buy whole chickens rather than pieced chickens, to substitute beans and nuts for meats, to do as much of their own cooking as they could, and to avoid buying processed foods. That was probably the moment where I realized I was studying food and food studies. I mean, that was advice that could have come from any of the domestic advice shows on the Food Channel. And in this moment of incredible political transformation and economic transformations over the course of the 20th century, understandings of domesticity and gender, right, and whose job it is to save money and how that work happens have stayed remarkably stable. And I think the stability of that discourse around women and their work is quite telling. I mean, it suggests what is at the bedrock of exchange and all sorts of other systems in the United States. I was struck that, you know, grocery stores could be radically revised, and other aspects of American governance without a similar revision in understandings of food buying and domestic work and reproductive labor. And it spoke to me about the significance of gender to food distribution and grocery stores and the ways that visions of women have become entrenched in the ways food is bought and sold, and that structural changes are in many ways obscured by allusions to this gendered rhetoric of women's demand. So I think that's it. Thank you guys very much. I'm happy to sign books.